Web Services and .NET 6 with Rob Richardson.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. They are hiring architects and .NET engineers who'd like a path to become architects, so you can go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And if you have a comment or question for the show, send an email to podcast@palermo.network. And also, another plug for my new online TV show that's launched. We're into episode 11. You can search for, quote, Programming with Palermo in any of the podcast directories or YouTube or any search engines at this point. You can also find it at www.palermo.network. And my guest today is a repeat guest from episode 131, Rob Richardson. And Rob is a software craftsman that's building web properties in ASP.NET, Node, React, and Vue, among others. And he's a software developer, a community leader, a mentor, and the business owner of Richardson & Sons. Additionally, Rob is a Microsoft MVP, a published author, a frequent speaker at conferences, user groups, and community events, and a diligent teacher and student of high-quality software development. Rob, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. It's so great to be back here.
Absolutely. Time flies. I think this is your third time on the show, but it was more than a year ago since the last one. So time indeed keeps rocking on.
Yeah. How did we let it go this long?
I don't know.
It is the 978th day of March 2020, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. I had to teach one of my daughters the month song so that she could know how many days are in each month. She was saying 30 days are in August, right? And so we had to get that corrected.
I actually found the really cool trick for this. If you take your hand and you take a look at your knuckles and you start at your first knuckle, so you know, mm-hmm. I'm on my index knuckle. January is 31 days. This one sticks up. The next one, I'm in between the knuckles. February has less than 31 days. March has 31. I'm at my middle finger. April has less than 31. I'm in between my two fingers. Going to the next finger, May has 31 days.
Yep.
June has 30 days. July has 31 days. And here's the part that always tricks us up. So I'm starting back again at the beginning, and August has 31 days. September has 30. October has 31. November has 30. And December has 31. And I'm here at my ring knuckle. I can't imagine how many times I'm counting on my fingers trying to figure out how many days of the month this has. So that's the way I solve it for myself.
That's a good trick. Yeah. You know, I think I'll show my kids that one. That's cool.
Yeah. Well,
you've been speaking at conferences and user groups. You were at Norwegian Developers Conference just a few months back, among other things. But before we dive into web services in .NET 6, for the listeners who maybe haven't caught episode 131 or the other show, just a little bit of your background, what you like to focus on in software, just so that the listeners kind of get to know you a little bit more.
One of the things that I really like to do in software is go find the unsolved problem and solve it. And so I started out just as a backend developer. You know, I guess this was back when we had server rendered sites, so there really wasn't a front end, but I was always eager to draw the short straw. So when it came time to how do we deploy this, then I figured out server administration, both for Windows and Linux servers. When it came time to automate that, then I dug in deep into DevOps. It was called continuous integration at the time. And I learned CI and CD, eventually now DevOps, and got good with init and cruise control, moved over to TeamCity, moved over to Azure DevOps, and now I do a lot on GitHub Actions. Simultaneously, let's draw the short straw on testing. And so I got really good at unit testing and integration testing. I do a lot with Cypress and MOQ or MockU. And so it's really fun to be able to dig into those things. One of the things that I love about that approach is that if you're only a front-end developer, every problem is a front-end problem. Mm-hmm. If you're a full stack developer and, you know, can even dig into the database schema and automation, then you can solve the problem where the problem is. It doesn't need to be that everything is a nail with your one hammer. So I love to be able to play the field and do all kinds of things.
Nice. Well, you gave a talk about this at NDC Web Services, actually minimal APIs and ASP.NET 6. And there's been so much movement in web services over the last few years. And there's some things that have made it easier, but there's some things that are still as nebulous as ever. But just before we kind of dive in .NET 6, what's the big wow capability that developers should not miss?
Minimal APIs are amazing at being able to take something really small and get it online in a single file. And so part of that demo, the minimal APIs in ASP.NET 6 talk is showing exactly that, where, for example, maybe I just need to accept a form post and send an email, or maybe I just need to accept a webhook and transition that into another data store or another web API. Or maybe I just need to transition data, you know, reshape the data, create some quick middleware. That's where minimal APIs can be amazing. Minimal APIs joins the other three web technologies, ASP.NET MVC, Web API, and Razor Pages. And none of the four of them are going away anytime soon. And each of them have their place. So what's really powerful is that we now have this fourth paradigm for building really simple, really easy, lightweight microservices. But we also kind of want to use that as the one hammer to rule them all. And so we're like, well, should I abandon Web API? Should I abandon MVC? No, in more industrial strength pieces, then those are definitely useful. If you have a minimal API that has, you know, four methods per entity, and you have 8 or 10 entities in your domain model, or maybe you have, you know, 80 or 100, then your minimal API is not minimal anymore. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you probably should flip over to Web API and use the controllers the way that they were designed previously. Yeah. Minimal APIs are perfect, though, if you have a really, really small thing, you just want to quickly spin up a microservice. And so if you have that small problem, upgrade to minimal APIs. If you have more of an enterprise-grade problem, you have, you know, monolith or lots of data within your model, then maybe Web API is the right choice. Or if you don't even want to manage your construct at all, then you can upgrade to Azure Functions or the functions in your cloud of choice. And so you now have this spectrum where previously you had to choose all of the weight of those conventions in Web API. Now, if you just have a really small problem, you can solve it in a really small way.
That's interesting. I'm just remembering how console apps have always been. You can jam some code in your program.cs and now you have a console app. But if you're doing anything serious or something that grows, you quickly outgrow just that program.cs file.
Right.
So with minimal APIs, is it different capabilities or have they faithfully mapped all of the capabilities of Web API down into those extension methods that you can use?
What I show in this demo that is really cool is you get all of the functions of Web API and MVC. You can do attribute routing. You parse query string parameters and post bodies. You can get your post body to automatically map into your C# classes. You can use authentication and authorization using OpenID Connect or basic authentication. You get Swagger discoverability inside your minimal APIs as well. All of the things that you were able to do with Web API, you can do with minimal APIs. In fact, as they were building out minimal APIs, they took that MVC and Web API stack and kind of lifted it up and stuck minimal APIs in the middle, set MVC and Web API on top of it. So a lot of people are like, well, is this going to be slower or faster? Minimal APIs may be a bit faster because it is a little bit lower down in the stack. But ultimately, because all of MVC flows through minimal APIs, then anything you can do in MVC, you can also do in minimal APIs.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. Well, let's go through some of the things that you just mentioned. Not the basic stuff of get and post. I think those are pretty discoverable, but let's just jump to authorization. Sorry, no, authentication, first of all, and give the listeners, because I even trip up saying one versus the other, remind us what the difference is between the two.
Yes. And it's really easy. And what makes it worse is that we all shorten them to auth. And it's like, oh, did you mean authentication or authorization? So sometimes we'll shorten them to auth-n and auth-z. Authentication meaning auth-n and authorization meaning auth-z. Authentication is about identifying who is the user. So with authentication, I'm usually presented a login dialog or maybe a fingerprint scanner, or I get redirected off to an external service. With authorization, it's validating that this user has permission to do this thing. So with authorization, we're checking roles. Now, I may use the same provider for accomplishing both things. I may use an ASP.NET authentication cookie to be able to validate my user. And baked into that cookie, I may add some roles. So I'm starting to blur that line really carefully. But we could also outsource authentication to an external provider. Maybe I have a login with GitHub button or a login with Google button. And so now the user's password is not stored in our system at all. When the token comes back from GitHub or Google or wherever the OpenID Connect provider came from, then we know that that identity is validated. At that point, we can make authorization decisions based on that identity. Do they have the ability to access these administrative features? Do they have these claims that allow them to do extra content? Can we identify their client ID based on their OAuth details? And so at that point, then we can make authorization decisions. We can make role-based decisions to be able to allow them or deny them access to features within our site.
Now, how do those login providers work for web services? When you have various other applications integrating, they're not going to look at a website with a, you know, login as Microsoft 365 or login as Google.
Yeah, usually when I'm authenticating to an API, there isn't really a login dialogue. So I'll probably come in with a JWT or a JSON web token. You can go to jwt.io and learn a whole lot about these JSON web tokens. What's really cool is that this is just a set of three blobs of JSON separated by dots that give us a signed version of that user identity. It's not encrypted. It's just signed. So we don't want to put any private information in here, but we can validate the signature inside this JOT. So we can say, yes, this token hasn't been manipulated since it was signed by that external provider. And so based on the details inside this JOT, we can get the user's identity, perhaps their name, maybe their email. We know how long the token is valid for, when it was created. And so we can make some of these decisions with this JOT. So we probably have an authorization header where instead of passing in a username and a password or passing in a SAML token or something like that, we say bearer and then a space, and then we'll put this JOT. And this JOT is, you know, safe to pass across the web because it's Base64 encoded JSON data. And so now I can just pass it in as one of those headers. So probably my client is attaching that information automatically. You know, if I've got a Blazor client, perhaps I've set up my HTTP web client factory to automatically inject this header whenever it goes to this URL. And at that point, then the authorization header, that JOT token, gets automatically published into the API anytime I contact that API. The API now knows the identity of this user, and unlike reading a cookie, it can just parse this JOT, this JSON web token, validate the signature, and then make authorization decisions based on that pre-validated identity.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
And which of these are built in where you don't need to go and grab another library, and which options are built in and which do you tend to prefer yourself?
The cool part is all of these are only a NuGet package away. And so I'll pull in the Jot Parser library, just part of pulling in any authorization mechanism. And so then I don't have to worry about all of the mechanism of parsing this library, parsing this JSON web token and pushing it into the user identity inside of ASP.NET. At that point, inside the middle of a request, I can just say this.user, and it will give me all of the claims associated with that Jot, but also the username and email address and all of the known properties come straight in as well.
Okay. And for this really simple case where you don't even have users, but you say, you know what, this is a private web service. I only want my applications even being able to do anything with it. Like you mentioned, look at the Blazor WebAssembly, where you're not flowing someone's identity through perhaps, but you say, I want my application one to be able to talk to my application two. What's your preferred mechanism there for kind of internal private web services?
What's really interesting, if we control both the server and the client, both the Blazor web app and the backend API, we can start to use less complicated authorization mechanisms. So at that point, maybe the Blazor app doesn't have any identity content at all. If the Blazor app is running on the same subdomain as the API, then the API can set an identity cookie like we did back in, you know, ASP.NET 1.0. And then anytime the Blazor app calls into the server, it's not calling to a different domain. It's just calling to, you know, /API/my site. And at that point, then the server, as it does, as it parses authentication cookies in any other way, can parse that authentication cookie and validate that the user is as they expect. At that point, that HTTP cookie can be set as HTTP only and HTTPS only, and that allows the server to be able to receive it on each request, but it blocks JavaScript and also Blazor from being able to manipulate that cookie in any way. And so at that point, then maybe I create an API endpoint that is like /API/auth login, and you pass in your username and password, I set that cookie. And then another one that is maybe /API/auth identity that just returns the profile details that the Blazor app needs. It's a really low tech and really elegant solution there because, well, we don't need to communicate between disinterested third parties. OpenID Connect and OAuth are both mechanisms for trusting third parties where we may not trust them directly, but we trust somebody else that trusts them. If we're controlling both sides, we don't need that weight.
Yeah, that's a good point. And are there any NuGet packages that people need to pull to use that technique, or is that how much of that is the default way?
That's just built in. You know, setting forms authentication details are just a matter of doing that. It gets a little bit weird if you're doing OWN websites with .NET framework, but pre-OWN and post-OWN, it just works. It's built in.
Now you have to remind us what OWN is, because that might be some history that people have missed.
Yeah, there's knocking some cruft off the barnacles there. We had .NET framework, and .NET framework was great, but it was also Windows only. We started experimenting with how can we open source .NET things, and we started this alt.NET movement. Alt.NET kind of grew into, what if the web server and the web framework were different? So we had this OWN API where ASP.NET didn't know much about IIS and IIS didn't know much about ASP.NET, but they had this really elegant interface of how to communicate between them. And so I forget exactly what OWN, it's an acronym. So I forget exactly what it stands for. We can go find that and set it in the show notes.
I don't remember either.
But it was that interface between IIS and ASP.NET. As we move towards ASP.NET core, instead we move towards, well, what if IIS just wasn't part of it and ASP.NET was robust enough to be able to expose public web services to the internet. We baked that web server inside of a container, and that became Kestrel.
Yeah. Open web interface for .NET.
Yes.
might have guessed that one, but yeah, there's so many code names and things that have come along the way, and a lot of the technology gets baked into the stack in a different place. So that technology right. is still living around, but it got rearranged a bunch.
Yeah. And right. so the cool part is the process of encrypting those forms authentication tickets and baking them into a cookie, that's been baked into ASP.NET since the beginning. And so, you know, back in the .NET framework days, we'd say forms authentication.login. Mm-hmm. We now need to do it in a little bit less stateful way. You know, we're not calling static methods on things, but it's a similar mechanism for saying, hey, go log in with this username and mm-hmm. persist this other user identity data. It's super easy.
Yeah. And that's really interesting because no matter what the application is, even native desktop applications or IoT, Raspberry Pi, Meadow, any application that's running .NET kind of has access to a web server. It could pop up a single web service and just open up a listening port. And now it's a tiny miniature web service. Am I missing anything, or is that one of the first class use cases?
Yeah, exactly. And that's where minimal APIs really shine, because maybe I'm on a Raspberry Pi or another really hardware limiting device where I just need to open up a single port that listens for a single type of traffic and just do some little thing. Maybe I have a bunch of Arduinos spread out that are reading temperature data or, you know, moisture data, or waiting for somebody to walk past the sensor. And the Arduino then kicks up and fires off a web request to something that's listening. You know, maybe I have a IoT gateway on a Raspberry Pi that just says, hey, I'm a web server and I'm accepting traffic. So maybe that's a minimal API that just, I don't know, does it log it in a SQLite database, or does it proxy it off to Azure Event Hub or another more durable place, or does it do a little bit more analytics there? That's the perfect spot for minimal APIs.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, what else are you working on these days? What other projects or talks or classes?
I'm actually doing a really cool talk that I'm getting ready for. I'll probably be done by the time this broadcast. I have a talk that details how to deploy a SPA and an API, a single page application or a progressive web app together with its API. A lot of times when we're looking at containerized applications, we containerize either the SPA or the API, and then we presume that something magic will happen to connect the two. And so in this talk, I'm exploring, should we have one container or two? And should it get deployed to one domain or two? You know, maybe I have api.mysite.com and www.mysite.com. And so kind of exploring the pros and cons of each of those approaches. It's going to be really fun. I get to do that talk later this week.
So you're still formulating your opinion on which approach you like?
What's really cool about this talk, and I first did it at Prairie DevCon in Winnipeg, where I presented each of those mechanisms and the pros and cons of doing it. And so ultimately, the magic question is, well, which one is the best? It depends. It depends on what your use case is. If you have a monolith, you know, you have one backend API and one front-end SPA, and you just want to host them on, say, Netlify or an Azure web app, then baking them into one container as a monolith could be really elegant. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you have a whole lot of microservices, then perhaps running each microservice in its own pod allows us to be able to scale them independently. So moving to lots of different containers could be really elegant. The hard part about then moving them to separate domains or even subdomains is now we have to do a whole lot of cores content. How do we get the one to reach across to the other domain? Because by default, browsers will block that. Mm-hmm. And so as we talk about two containers, two domains, then I'll show the intricacies of how to set up cores. It's not easy because not only do I have to tell the server what the client URL is, I also have to tell the client what the server URL is. And it's going to change in each environment. So in dev, I build the container this way. And in test, I build the container that way. But that also means that I can't promote the same container image between dev and test. I have to rebuild. And then what's really elegant is with Kubernetes, I can create an ingress controller or an ingress configuration rather that plugs into my ingress controller. And it can say, okay, so I'm accepting traffic for example.com. Mm-hmm. And if it is example.com/API, then I'll send it to this container. And if it's example.com, anything else, I'll send it to this container. And so with an ingress, I can say, let's host the SPA and the API in different containers on the same domain. And that's one of the things that we don't usually think of in this. We're like, okay, so two containers, therefore two domains. Mm-hmm. But plugging them behind an API gateway or an ingress controller and ingress is really elegant to be able to create that mechanism of scaling all of those services independently without the additional overhead of creating cores. So that'll be fun to be able to explore. What's unique about this talk Thursday is it's actually at a Java conference. So they said, really? Can you replace all your .NET samples with Java samples? Sure. Yeah, that'll be no big deal. Apparently it was a big deal.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, if the code is on the slides, then you don't care if it compiles.
But... yeah, except for these are all live demos. I'm going to fire up each of the three scenarios. Here's the containers by themselves. Look, they don't talk to each other. Here's the one big monolithic container. Here's the two containers on two domains and all the cores mayhem I had to do. And here's hooking it up through ingress.
So did you reach for IntelliJ or Eclipse?
I did everything in Spring Boot and I'm using VS Code and dev containers to be able to debug it.
Very nice. Wow. Man, yeah. VS Code has gotten so many good plugins.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. And dev containers is such a magical thing. It's like, I want to go play with another language, but I don't want to install the everything. So I'll just go pop open a container. And because VS Code splits itself in half, half of it runs inside the container with all the language features. So, here I am debugging and typing Java. But then the other half is the UI piece that runs on my machine. And that gives me all the theming and colors and other things that I want, the fonts that I want. And so I get this great development experience for a language that is not installed on my machine. It is beautiful. It's wonderful.
Wow. Nice. Well, as we kind of close up here and get to the end of our time, that's one really cool project. Are there any other projects or upcoming announcements or new tech that you're kind of keeping an eye on and looking forward to?
I'm digging deep into GitHub Actions, and I'm starting to build out custom GitHub Actions tasks for interesting things. In a GitHub Action, you can kind of do anything, but then it's a little bit awkward. It's like, well, do I apt-get install in the middle of my build? And so creating a custom action that has that piece is really elegant. Kind of the intermediary step between those is that you can run random content out of a container. So I can just troll through Docker Hub and pick an interesting container and then run that content inside my GitHub action.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because you're right, using apt-get or installing anything on the fly onto the host, it just adds to your build time.
Right.
Awesome.
That together with GitHub Actions services, which allow you to spin up a data store, maybe Redis or Postgres, and then use it through the duration of your build. And that temporary environment is perfect for doing all the experiments that you need to run all your integration tests, but it's not a durable data store. So you don't have to, reset it at the end of the build. It just goes away.
Nice. Well, hey, thanks for coming back on the Azure DevOps podcast. It's great to catch up with you, and sounds like you got some really interesting projects going on.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun to catch up. I'm glad we were able to do this.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks so much. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.